Hello and welcome to the Deathcast. I'm your host, author, and journalist Ian Tott, and I'd like to thank you for joining me as we prepare to take our second look at Joseph Paul Franklin. Before we get going, as always, I have the normal show notes. If you'd like to follow me on social media, just search Deathcast, Deathcast Official, or Deathcast Podcast. If you'd like to help support the show, there's a couple of ways you can do this. First and foremost, you can go to your favorite podcasting app, subscribe, and leave a 5-star review. If you don't like the show, don't say a fucking thing. Talking to you, are you morbid? You can also go to tinyurl.com/decastpatreon, where for as little as $1.99 a month, you can get access to early ad-free shows as well as exclusive content. Just like my first two Patreon members, Channel and Anthony, did, as well as my largest monthly Patreon contributors, Debbie and Samantha. That's tinyurl.com/decastpatreon. All right, now that all of that's out of the way, find yourself a nice comfy chair, kick back, and relax. If you're at work, I hope this helps you get through the day. I've got my coffee. I've got my cigarettes. Let's go into the crypt! When we left off last time, it was the summer of 1980, and Joseph Paul Franklin had gone on a killing spree, murdering at least 6 people that we are aware of, as well as attempting to assassinate civil rights leader Vernon Jordan. The last thing we had discussed was how Franklin had murdered 19-year-old Nancy Sumatero and 26-year-old Vicky Durian. Now, this was in West Virginia, and after having committed these murders, Franklin fled the area, reasonably assuming that the car he had passed may have been able to identify the Chevy Nova he was driving, which Franklin was correct in assuming, as unbeknownst to him, there were paint chips left behind on one of the women's bodies. It was also likely that there was forensic evidence inside of the car, which Franklin was surprisingly aware of existing. So by June, he was in Kentucky, specifically in the Lexington area. We know that he purchased a 1975 Chevy Camaro for $2,300. Franklin is able to stay on the road for an extended period of time, and it's very likely that he was committing small robberies along the way to supplement the money that he had stolen from the bank. Now, we know that he hung around the Lexington, Kentucky area for a few days, getting tires for the car as well as having it repainted. Around the end of July, he ends up in Florence, Kentucky, where he checks into a hotel. Later, the woman who cleans the hotel is going to inform authorities that she had seen vast amounts of money inside of Franklin's hotel room, which gives us something of an indication to his mindset at this point in time. Up until Franklin committed this series of murders in 3 states that he referred to as the Triangle Murders, as they formed a triangle on a map, he had been extremely meticulous in his activities as well as in keeping those activities secret from others, making certain that things like his weaponry and the ill-gotten gains he had acquired at the various places he robbed were out of sight. Now, though, we've got Franklin leaving money lying around in the hotel where the cleaning girls can come in and see it lying there. But he's also doing other things to leave a trail. The car that he had purchased in Lexington in June was never transferred over to his ownership. Basically meaning that once the former owner informs the DMV that he no longer is in possession of the car, it can be listed as stolen. He also ends up turning in his Indiana license at the end of July for a Kentucky license, and he lists his address as being in Erlanger, Kentucky. And he ends up using a hotel in this town as his mailing address. We know with certainty that Franklin's wife, who we're going to get into eventually, received birthday cards at this address in Erlanger. We also know that Franklin traveled to Alabama to visit with his wife during this period of time, and his wife would later state that she saw at least one rifle inside of the Camaro before Franklin left, heading for Salt Lake City, Utah. Now, I don't know what Salt Lake City was like back at the beginning of the 1980s, but I know now, having been there a few times and seeing it as one of my least favorite places in America, that it's your typical city, but with a twist. There's a lot of rednecks in the city, a lot of Mormons, a lot of shady shit going down there. And this is reflected by the fact that during this point in time, the 1970s, 1980s, at least according to a retired investigator by the name of Jim Bell, Salt Lake City had been host to a unusual amount of serial murders. And again, according to this investigator, it actually holds the distinction of as having had more serial murders take place inside of it than any other city, something I contend is a little bit boisterous when, if you look at actual graphs of serial murder, Los Angeles has an exorbitant amount of serial murders that have taken place within the county, but also in the city itself, and these murders continue on in various areas of the city to this day. In any event, Salt Lake City, then as is now, is fed by two major highways that travel across the country, I-80 and I-15, both of them passing through the city. So there's a large constant influx and outflow of people into this city. Joseph Paul Franklin was one such individual who passed through Salt Lake City. As with his previous murders, Franklin was looking for interracial couples to murder. We know that he checked into the Evergreen Hotel on August 9th. However, he quickly left after he found what he claimed were the hairs of a black person on his bed. Apparently, he had a confrontation with the manager about this, at which time Franklin left and headed to the World Motor Hotel, where he stayed for at least two nights. After this, Franklin registers in different hotels using the alias of Joseph Hart at most of them. And at least at one of the areas that Franklin stayed in, the manager was so put off by him, suspecting him of being on drugs, the manager actually broke the law and went into Franklin's room and searched his stuff, finding a handgun. Before I get a bunch of people saying, oh, it's not illegal for someone to go into your hotel room and go through your stuff, actually, it violates the privacy provision of the Constitution. And once you take possession of it, it is basically your domicile. While you can't destroy the property other than for maintenance, no one can go inside of the room and just go through your stuff. And I say this having just dealt with a case wherein law enforcement could not enter someone's hotel room who was flooding a building because they would need a warrant to do so. Having spoken with these officers, they explained that it's the same thing for hotel staff. They have to get permission for you to go inside of the room to do maintenance, technically even cleaning. And while they can always try and claim that they suspected that something underhanded was going on, somebody really wants to push the issue in court, the hotel is going to end up losing. The same as if someone at a hotel suspected you were, you know, transporting something in your car that you shouldn't be. If they went inside of your vehicle, they would be trespassing. It falls under the same statutes. In any event, Franklin ends up checking into another hotel later on in the week, where the manager doesn't believe the license plate number that he gave him was correct. Later on, the manager gets the correct license plate number and puts it down in the registry. Why is this important? Franklin was known to change the license plates on the vehicles that he drove in order to avoid the police. However, by leaving the original plates on this car, Joseph Paul Franklin is later going to be able to be linked to crimes that took place in Salt Lake City. Crimes, I have to add, Franklin insisted up until his dying day that he did not commit. Unlike previous times, it seems as though Franklin was possibly looking to settle in the Salt Lake City area. We know that he interacted with numerous individuals, particularly women, even taking one woman out on a date, which was said to be rather uneventful, although the woman did state that Franklin spoke at length about blacks and whites during this outing, and that this seemed to turn the young woman off. When he spoke to her later that evening, she informed him that she did not want to see him again. Again, this is all out of character for Franklin, who prior to this, when he went to an area to commit a crime, stayed largely to himself and did his best to avoid detection and human interactions. This could either be that he's looking to settle down at this point, or Franklin could have gotten to that part of his killings that so many killers get into, where they begin to believe that they are invincible, they can't be caught, and they're really starting to spiral in terms of breaking from their normal modus operandi and doing things that are out of character for them. At some point during this week, Franklin brought his car to a local Chevy dealership to have the front right bumper repaired as well as the turn signal. This is further proof that Franklin is kind of embedding himself into the community in Salt Lake City. On August 17th, he approached two underage girls who were working as prostitutes, picking one of them up. They engaged in sexual relations before, as the girl said to authorities, Franklin started talking about how much he disliked black people. His favorite subjects were, quote, killing and, quote, killing N-words. This girl later told authorities that Franklin offered to kill her pimp if she wanted to, before descending into a diatribe about the best ways to kill, saying, quote, wait until they were in a crowd and shoot them. Later on, according to this girl, she mentioned that she had two black pimps. Franklin again stated that he would kill them if she wanted. The girl is supposed to have told Franklin that he would be caught, to which Franklin responded, you follow them and you pick out the right time. Even if it's in a crowd, you can just shoot them, and if there's enough cars or something hiding you, you can get away with it. Franklin also told this young girl that he was a member of the KKK, before giving her a rundown of the organization and how it was spread out throughout the United States. Franklin also supposedly told this girl that he was a contracted killer for the KKK, and offered her a gun that he had in his possession if she would shoot a black man that happened to be standing on the sidewalk while they were standing at a stop sign. The girl declined his offer, and it's uncertain whether or not she believed him when Franklin informed her that he had killed blacks in the past and asked her to give him a list of all the black pimps operating in Salt Lake City so he could come back and kill them one by one. Again, they had sexual intercourse, at which point Franklin insisted the young girl pose nude for him as he took photographs of her posing with his weaponry. Apparently, Franklin had other interactions with prostitutes while he was in Salt Lake City. There is good amount of evidence, specifically photographic evidence, that leads us to believe that Franklin visited with at least two other prostitutes during his time in the city. And it's almost certain that he spoke to these women in a similar fashion. If you listen to the last episode, you know that this is a massive departure for Joseph Paul Franklin, not only in terms of how he operates, but also his personality as a whole. He was a self-described loner, really didn't seem to fit in with anyone or group, despite having been a member of the American Nazi Party and the Ku Klux Klan. So for him to go off like this to various strangers in a city where he's looking for someone to kill is extremely odd. But again, we have multiple individuals who encountered Franklin during the weeks that he was in Salt Lake City that attest to him having said and behaved in such a manner. Which brings us to August 20th of 1980. We know that Franklin picked up two hitchhikers, 445 East 800 South Street. The girls were hitchhiking to a check cashing place, and according to statements they later gave to the police, Franklin asked if either of them would be interested in going out with them, and despite being quote-unquote frightened of the man, They both gave him their names and addresses. Franklin went through his normal spiel concerning blacks, asking the girls if either of them had ever been in a relationship with a black man, before dropping them off and giving them a card with the initials FBI printed on it. Now, both of these girls would later tell the police that they saw Franklin and the Camaro he was driving in downtown Salt Lake City between 9 and 9:20 p.m. At roughly 10 p.m., an individual saw a Camaro, which was later matched to the description of the one that Franklin drove, near Liberty Park, where John Paul Franklin had learned from one of the prostitutes the city's black males congregated trying to pick up women. Now, backtracking a little bit, at roughly 9 p.m., a 20-year-old black male by the name of Theodore T. Fields contacted his 15-year-old former girlfriend, Karma Ingersoll, and asked her if she wanted to go jogging. Despite Ingersoll's family's objections to her dating and seeing a black male, Karma agreed, asking her friend, another 15-year-old by the name of Terry Elrod, if she wanted to join them, and despite her misgivings, Terry agreed. Now, neither girl knew that Theodore Fields had invited a friend of his, an 18-year-old by the name of David L. Martin, was going to be joining them. Supposedly, the trio met up at 700 West and 900 South. Ted drove all of them back to his home, and the foursome began jogging towards Liberty Park. One of the girls later stated that as they jogged, they heard someone calling their names, but as they were too busy running, they did not look to see who it was. This was, in fact, a friend of both Terry and Karma's named Earl Burnett. At roughly this same point in time, an individual saw a Camaro being driven northbound on the west loop of Liberty Park, jumping a curb before continuing northbound on 500 East. This same individual saw the Camaro park in an empty parking lot, and the driver, whom he described as being roughly 6 feet tall, with shoulder-length hair, emerge and head into the park. Inside Liberty Park, Theodore and the three others were jogging on the west loop, coming up on a set of tennis courts. Karma and Terry complained of being tired and decided to stop and rest. Eventually, they met up with Theodore and David again for exiting the park at 600 East and 900 South. At roughly 10:15 p.m., as the four of them are in a crosswalk, when an individual suddenly opened fire on them. According to Terry, Theodore and Karma were in front while she and David were behind them. Terry ends up being hit before David suddenly falls to the ground. Karma and Terry then flee the scene, where they eventually encountered a woman by the name of Mary Biddlecombe. Back at the crosswalk, the unseen shooter continued to open fire, eventually hitting Ted. Police later stated that a total of 6 shots had been fired at the four. David was shot 3 times, while Ted had been shot 2, with one of the bullets perforating his aorta artery. Obviously, and unfortunately, both of these men end up dying from their gunshot wounds. Now, multiple people heard the gunshots ran into their windows, came to their doors, that type of thing. The individual who saw the Camaro parking saw the driver in a grassy field shooting a gun towards the crosswalk before turning around, dropping towards a crouch, and rushing back to his car, throwing the rifle into the vehicle as he fled. Another motorist, realizing that there was a shooting occurring, drove their car in front of the victims and parked it across the crosswalk in the hopes of shielding them from further gunfire. After the fact, that is a few days later, the prostitutes who had been in the company of Franklin remembered him, recalling the things that he had said as they saw the various news reports about this shooting that had occurred. However, none of them were willing to come forward as they feared both being charged with prostitution but also being taken advantage of by the police. Multiple individuals attempted to help both David and Theodore. However, Theodore was dead at the scene. David died at the hospital a few hours later. While all of that's going on, Karma and Terry, who had fled, eventually reach a telephone. Karma calls her father. Her father is furious as he had been under the impression that his daughter was simply going out to go jogging with Terry. Because of this and tips that police received concerning Karma's father and his views on blacks, the police initially considered him a person of interest. However, after interviewing the man, it became clear to them that while he harbored no ill will towards anyone of African American descent, he did not want his daughter dating one. They also realized fairly quickly that he was not in any way, shape, or form responsible for the shooting attack. A detective Lowe's later quoted as saying, "These were two young boys. They'd never been in trouble with the police. We didn't have an outstanding motive. We didn't know whether it was something related to the girls, whether it was something related to the boys, or simply just a case of mistaken identity. We'd never had a homicide like this in Salt Lake City. We'd never had people just gunned down, especially young people gunned down in the middle of the intersection." Eventually, police came to the conclusion after involving the ATF in ballistics testing that the gun most likely used was a Glenfield 30-30. Because of how brazen this particular murder was, police had a slew of information coming in concerning the perpetrator's physical description. They quickly amassed a series of composite sketches, but they also put out a $5,000 reward, leading to information that would lead to the arrest or identification of the suspect. This led to the police being inundated by individuals turning in rifles, claiming to have purchased the gun from an individual who resembled Joseph Paul Franklin. Now, the police began to fear pretty early on that there was going to be some backlash from the black community, as it was felt by many that there was a perceived hatred of blacks within the Mormon church. The reason this is an issue is Salt Lake City is predominantly Mormon. To assuage these fears, the chief of police announces at a press conference that there is no racial motivation behind these murders. We'll be back in just a moment.
Hey there, my D&Ders. This is your old buddy Ian here with a brand new sponsor this week. Now, you've all heard me talk about Chinese teachers in the past. I have never promoted a Chinese teacher quite like Chinese teacher Evian. Evian is a sweet, honest, and dedicated teacher who teaches every day. She not only makes certain that her students understand the differences in tonal pronunciation, she allows them the opportunity to get up during the class and read what it is that she is teaching so that each student knows that they are getting the best possible education and is pronouncing the words and tones correctly. So I'd like you to do right now is go to tinyurl.com/EvianCT and check her out. That's tinyurl.com/EvianCT. She makes learning this beautiful and wonderful language a lot of fun. And remember, Mandarin Chinese is the fastest growing language in the international job market today. This is the language that you want to learn if you don't want to work that boring 9-to-5 job, but you want to get a foothold in a company that has an international presence. They're all looking for Mandarin speakers. So let Evian be the one to introduce you to this language. You won't be disappointed.
Hey there, D&Ders. Your friend Ian here with another brand new sponsor this week. Artwork by Katie. Now, as the son of a fairly successful artist, I grew up around the art world, saw many different styles of art. I know good art from bad, and I can honestly say that in addition to being a good friend, Katie is one of the best artists I have ever had the pleasure of seeing. Her works of art, be it drawings or paintings, are absolutely amazing. And Katie doesn't just do original works of art, she also does commission pieces. So if you're looking for that perfect piece of art to offset the decor in your home, office, or even in your place of business, go check out Artwork by Katie at linktr.ee/KatieArtworks. That's linktr.ee/KatieArtworks. You'll be blown away.
This in turn had the dire consequence of leading police down different avenues that had nothing to do whatsoever with the actual committing of these crimes and the individual who's responsible for them. One of these leads involved an individual who had allegedly raped Terry Elrod the previous year. The man was currently out on bail at the time awaiting trial, and Terry thought that the man may have targeted her in an effort to silence her during the trial. Other individuals considered suspects at one time or another included Terry's father, who was said to be a member of a 1% biker group, as well as a member of the Ku Klux Klan. In their internal notes, the police noted that Terry's father did not approve of his daughter being in a relationship with a black male, and because his daughter had allegedly been raped by a black man, had decided to take steps to ensure that the relationship his daughter was currently engaged in came to an abrupt, violent end. However, according to Terry, her father had no problem with the relationships that she had been involved in, had met Theodore Fields on a number of occasions, and had no problem with him. The police end up investigating this particular avenue for quite some time before coming to the conclusion that no one in the family or in the father's biker gang had anything to do with the killings. Another avenue that the police became sidetracked on involved the idea that Theodore Fields may have been selling drugs. This came from Karma, who informed the police that Ted had in fact been selling marijuana on the side, telling officers that prior to the shooting, Ted had been trying to get together $300 so that he could go out and buy some weed in order to sell it. Karma informed the police that she had been willing to put up half of the money if Ted could get the rest of it, and this was further corroborated when another individual came forward and told the police that about a week prior to the slaying, Ted had approached him and asked if he wanted to put up $75 in order to buy speed so that he could resell it for a profit. Another individual by the name of Earl Bennett came forward and told authorities that the only reason that David Martin had been shot was because the two of them resembled one another. Bennett claimed that he and Fields were close friends and that both men were dating prostitutes between May and July of that year. Bennett claimed that both men had tried to persuade the girls from working as prostitutes and that the girls' pimps had become enraged about this, although no direct threats were made to either men. When questioned about this, Karma stated that it was a possibility that one of the girls had arranged for the hit. When questioned about this, Terry stated she had been told that the pimps had made direct threats towards Ted Fields. And police learned later that one of the pimps had informed Fields, quote, "If I ever see you alone on the street, I'll get you." Lee denied making this statement, and after questioning everyone involved in it, this too turned up to be a dead-end street. Eventually, police had to return to the scene of the crime. This is what led them to Gary Spicer, who is the man that had seen the Camaro pulling into the parking lot, and also seen the shooter outside in the field, telling officers that the man was tall and slender and had been packing and unpacking something in the back of his car. When Spicer attempted to speak to the man jumped into his car and drove away. Police were pretty much at their wits' end at this point when the Justice Department gets involved, thinking that civil rights may have been violated. This, in turn, led to the FBI becoming involved, and it was pretty quickly ascertained that although the public believed that another such shooting may happen, more likely than not, the individual responsible for having committed this double homicide had fled the area. So the FBI puts out a teletype, which was the precursor to the fax machine, to all of their field offices with a $50,000 reward describing the car that had been seen, as well as the individual believed to have been responsible for these crimes. And while all of this information is being disseminated across the country, the police stumble upon a lead, and that is in the form of one of the prostitutes who had been with Joseph Paul Franklin. This young woman knew Franklin under the name of Bill Hagman. Police initially thought that this young woman was either a false witness or an unreliable witness. However, the more she talked, the more information that she gave the police, the more they began to become convinced that she was in fact telling the truth and that she had most likely been involved with the man who had committed these murders. Eventually, another prostitute came forward and started to give corroborating testimony to the authorities, basically describing situations and language much as the first woman had. So desperate were police to try and identify the individual who had committed these crimes, they, perhaps humorlessly, turned to a psychic who, armed with information about the type of car the suspect was believed to be driving, was able to accurately give them a description of the black and white checkered seats inside of the Camaro, which, at this point, the police knew the year of the car, and they had passed that year on to the psychic, so it was not very difficult for her to contact Chevrolet and discover what types of seats had been available inside of that car. Police are stymied, they're turning to psychics, they have no idea what is going on. The FBI suddenly gets a response to the telex they had sent out, this time from Cincinnati. Cincinnati was in the process of investigating a double homicide that had taken place inside the city 2 months prior. And police in both jurisdictions began to compare notes to see the similarities that might exist there. Of course, this is going to eventually lead them to a suspect who was responsible for these crimes, Joseph Paul Franklin. Now, after having committed the murders in Salt Lake City, Franklin had left the area. He ends up heading north of Salt Lake City immediately after both men are shot, passing through the town of Ogden before getting on a freeway and traveling west into San Francisco, where, despite statements he would later give to police, it is alleged that Franklin sold the .30-30 he had used in the commission of the murders to a man at a gun show or a swap meet. It should be noted, however, that once investigators get this particular piece of information, they descend on this flea market, and while they could find witnesses who remembered seeing a man that resembled Joseph Paul Franklin, they could find no one who remembered him selling them the gun, nor did they ever find the weapon used in the murder. According to Franklin, however, he never drove to San Francisco. Instead, he states that he had returned to Johnstown before traveling to Florence, Kentucky. We know that by at least September 23rd, he was in Kentucky in possession of two wigs. Back on the police side of things, officers from around the country began connecting the dots as they saw the crime in Salt Lake City, then learned of the murders in Cincinnati and in Pennsylvania, Oklahoma City, and Indianapolis. According to former Salt Lake City Detective Don Bell, once we were made aware of this information, we were pretty much convinced we were dealing with the same killer from back east, and this was actually our first real involvement with what is commonly now referred to as a traveling serial killer. This was a new concept to everybody, not just out in Salt Lake, it was a new concept anywhere in the country, that killers would just travel across the country. Officers start reaching out to the various hotels and motels in the cities and towns surrounding Salt Lake City, basically going out roughly 30 miles in all directions, and what they quickly start finding is that an individual who matched the suspect's description as well as the vehicle description stayed at multiple hotels outside of the Salt Lake City area. Not only did they discover this, they also found that at each one the man gave a different name, different addresses, and different license plate numbers. Officers were actually able to link all of this together by checking out the hotel registries as well as signatures on receipts, and they learned fairly quickly that the handwriting matched and could only have come from one individual. All of this led them to learn that the as-yet unnamed suspect had stayed at the Scenic Motel about 9 blocks from the crime scene just prior to the murders occurring. Officers had been searching for fingerprints on everything and had as of yet come up with nothing until they got to the Scenic Motel, where it was discovered that there was one fingerprint found on the hotel registration card. Unfortunately, it matched no known suspects currently on file. And it's while they're processing all of this information, the various aliases and hotel stays, that officers came across the break that they were desperately seeking. This was at the Sandman Hotel. Well, if you'll recall, the hotel manager had gone out to double-check the license plate number that Franklin had given, only to discover that the number he had given was incorrect, so the man ends up writing down the correct license plate number. When Salt Lake City police looked at the hotel registry and saw this other number, they're eventually able to track the car down to a man by the name of William Embry Jr. from Lexington, Kentucky. And it's from this individual via the police in Lexington that the officers in Salt Lake City learn that the Camaro had been sold at some point in August. Now, because of the individual who had sold the car, his friend, and a prostitute that Franklin had engaged with while he was in Louisville, the police in Louisville were able to create a composite sketch, which, when compared to the composite sketch that officers in Salt Lake City had, bore a striking resemblance to one another. On September 15th, there was a meeting of representatives from various law enforcement agencies across the country where similar crimes had taken place. This was held in Cincinnati. And during the course of this meeting, where investigators basically compared notes, they saw that a number of striking similarities and patterns began to appear. For the most part, the victims of the sniper attacks were alone or in a pair when a shooting had occurred, with the shooting having taken place from above. While the victims were primarily African-American males, white females had been targeted in a number of instances wherein they were in the presence of a black male. It was also discovered that high-powered hunting rifles had been used in the course of these crimes. However, because of differences in the ballistics, none of these crimes were able to officially be linked together. With all of this information on the suspect and his vehicles, officers at this conference turned around and fed all of this information into the National Crime Information Center's computers. For those of you who don't know, the NCIC is part of the United States Justice Department. It's a database where information on missing individuals as well as criminal cases can be input for use by other law enforcement agencies as they attempt to either track an individual down who is missing or to solve a homicide that may bear similarities to homicides in other areas. That's just a very broad overview of it. All of this information is put into the computer, including the fact that a Camaro linked to this suspect is believed to have been used in the commission of a double homicide in Salt Lake City. On September 25th, the police got another major break in the case. But it was not in the way they were expecting to get a break. What happened was that Franklin had gone to Florence, Kentucky, and registered at the Scottish Inn, where he was put in a room 138 under his real name. This was on September 23rd. The following day, the 24th, he drove to Covington, where he got a duplicate license before heading back to the hotel. The next day, September 25th, officers from both the local police department as well as the Boone County Sheriff's Department went to the Scottish Inn to arrest a man by the name of Gary Kirk. Now, Kirk was a 19-year-old Native American man that police believed was responsible for armed robbery, possession of drugs, as well as possession of a stolen vehicle. Now, this man was staying in the room next to Franklin's, and he became so incensed by the police presence, he actually contacted the manager of the hotel, but the police dispatcher, complain about the amount of noise the officers were making. Now, he didn't just do this once. Franklin called the police dispatcher numerous times to the point that the chief of police eventually got on the line and informed him that they were not looking for him, they were just arresting someone for a robbery. When the hotel manager encountered one of the officers who was on scene and informed them that a guest had complained of their presence and the fact that they were blocking his car in, officers decided to run the plates on the Camaro, and upon learning that Franklin's car was wanted in connection to a double homicide in Salt Lake City, they went and knocked on his door. Franklin answered the door. Officers saw two shotguns on his bed and immediately placed Franklin under arrest. According to officers, Franklin had multiple forms of ID on him made out to various names, and when questioned about whether or not he'd ever been to Salt Lake City or to the state of Utah, he had first denied it before stating he had been there once 5 years prior, changing this to sometime in August and becoming extremely nervous and evasive when officers asked him about the possibility of his involvement in a double homicide. Obviously, Franklin's car is impounded. The officers in Kentucky know that this is more likely than not a pretty bad dude. They contact authorities in Salt Lake City, who very quickly dispatch a pair of detectives to talk with Franklin. And while he is waiting to be spoken to by investigators from Salt Lake City, investigators turn their attention to the car Franklin was driving, as he had changed the tires that were originally on it, gotten a new paint job, various other things that made his Camaro stand out as something that witnesses would remember. They're hoping to match the car to a set of tire prints found in the parking lot near where David and Thomas had been gunned down. When officers from Salt Lake City arrived in Kentucky, they began questioning Franklin. They noticed pretty quickly that he would repeatedly repeat their questions to him, pause during his statements to them, and became upset when questioned about double homicide. And now this is where shit gets crazy. Officers are talking to Franklin. There's a knock on the door. One of the officers goes to answer it to find out that a search warrant has been granted for Franklin's car. While the officers are speaking, Franklin simply gets up and jumps out the window. He runs down the street, sticks his thumb out, and catches a ride out in front of the local hospital at roughly 9 a.m. Franklin ends up being driven to a restaurant on Dixie Highway, where he encounters another individual who agrees to drive Franklin to Cincinnati. Once in Cincinnati, Franklin has his hair dyed, purchases a new pair of clothing and shoes, and then gets on a bus to Columbus, Ohio. From there, Franklin goes to Charleston, West Virginia, Winston-Salem, North Carolina, and then eventually down to Atlanta. This was somewhere around September 27th, where he obtains a birth certificate under the name of Joseph Kitts. And that is where we're going to leave the episode for this week, with Joseph Paul Franklin on the run from the law down in Atlanta, and a nationwide manhunt underway to locate this mysterious man suspected of killing two people in Salt Lake City and multiple others across the country. Hope you enjoyed this week's episode. And again, if you want to support the show, please don't forget to go to tinyurl.com/dcastpatreon, where for as little as $1.99 a month, you can get access to early ad-free shows and exclusive content. And that's for all tiers. All right, until next time, stay morbid.